Hello and welcome to yet another edition of Innovation Odyssey. Today I have with me in the studio, all the way from Philadelphia, Nick Jain, who is the CEO of IdeaScale. Welcome to the podcast, Nick.
Thank you so much, Renu, for having me.
How are you?
I'm doing well. It is a Friday. It's starting to finally cool down after a very, very hot summer here in Philadelphia. And my wife just got back from a work trip, so it's I get to spend some time with her, which will be a nice weekend.
That really sounds like a nice weekend. We still have some heat over here, although it's actually, I think it's going to rain. I'm in Basel, Switzerland, and I can see we are getting into fall. I feel it, which is good because fall is a great time of the year, right? And so anyway, I like to start asking my guests to talk about who they are and what they do all in 30 seconds. So the stage is yours.
So my name is Nick Jain. I'm the CEO of IdeaScale. We are the largest innovation software company in the world, been around 15 years, worked with organizations like NASA and Comcast, US Coast Guard. We're often the software that sits at the heart of their innovation system. As for me personally, I grew up in a mix of India and Canada before emigrating to the US for college, did my undergrad in math and physics at Dartmouth and an MBA at Harvard Business School, and have now worked across four different industries. I was a Wall Street investor for a long time, then helped run a trucking company, then helped run a men's shoe company, and now I've been at IdeaScale for about 2 years.
Wonderful. I love it. I love the 30-second pitch because I get a lot, and then I can get to pick and choose in what order I want to talk to them about it. Okay, let's start with IdeaScale. I am actually surprised to know that it's been around for 15 years. Like, is it like a software that a big company can use to collect innovation ideas?
Our software is really good for large organizations that have people working in different silos, different geographies, different languages, because they can't get together in one room and just share ideas with one another. So what our software does is it allows you to collect ideas from people all over the company or organization or nonprofit. So the CEO's ideas, the janitor's ideas, the R&D scientist ideas, they can all come in the same place. They can be upvoted and downvoted, and you can figure out what the best ideas are and then move them towards reality. So it's a good system for collecting ideas, figuring out what are good versus bad ideas, and then actually turning them, those ideas into executed reality.
In a company, who is the owner of IdeaScale if they have it in their systems?
Yeah, so we primarily work with four different departments. Number one, a lot of large organizations now actually have chief innovation officers. So if those departments exist, both within the government and private sector companies, we love to work with chief innovation officers. The other three departments where we actually spend a lot of time working with are the human resources departments, because our software is a very good way to engage with your employee base. Number three, your technology departments. So under the office of the CTO. And then finally, your product departments, the people who are building your product. And that could be chips, like potato chips, all the way to software, because you need constantly new ideas for how to make your product better or to make new products.
And but who is, I guess, who is the final touch point? Because innovation is many a times about making a decision at the right time, you know, for it to be successful. So who is the touch point? The final touch point.
In a lot of departments, in a lot of organizations, the person who's bought our software, that could be the chief human resources officer, could be the chief innovation officer. He or she does have discretionary decision-making authority to move something from just an idea on digital paper to reality. So our clients tend to be the final decision maker, obviously, unless it's like a multi-billion dollar project, and then it'll go up to the office of the CEO and it'll become a much more complex decisioning process.
Okay, so when you join a company, are you're onboarded generally? Is this something that you would be onboarded onto as well immediately?
It depends how well deployed we are within an organization. So there are some of our clients where our software is used company organization wide. In that case, yes, you'd be onboarded onto IdeaScale. You'd get your user ID for your email at your company would let you into our IdeaScale software automatically. Alternatively, if we're working just within, let's say, the IT department or the innovation department, especially in innovation departments where we're such a core piece of software, this would be one of the things you would learn within the first week or so of using. And literally it takes about 30 seconds to learn how to use the software because it is designed to be, you know, as I say, stupid simple.
So if someone has an innovation in code, it's updating a code or writing a new line of code, can that be done there? Like saying, I come from the IT, can be done there.
So I'll use an example. So we use our own software ourselves, as you should. You should always eat your own cooking, right? So we have some fun examples of we were using our software to collect ideas for what our new company mascot should be. We collected ideas from our customers and from our employees and everyone. So that was a more fun one. But then we also have a campaign running for our engineering team, where they're focused on, hey, where are areas of our code base that could be improved, refactored, or just new technical improvements we can make, and suggestions for that. So we are actually using it for very technical topics as well as more lighthearted topics like mascots.
Okay. And how do you measure success?
Sure. So each organization measures success in different ways, depending on what is valuable to them. A government organization versus nonprofit versus private sector organization may measure things differently. I generally encourage our clients to measure things on three different core dimensions, depending on what's valuable to their organization. Firstly, is a financial ROI metric or return on investment metric. That's particularly important to more financially minded private sector organizations. Secondly, is employee engagement, or sorry, it doesn't have to be employee, your constituent engagement, because some of our government clients use it to engage with the citizenry. And number three is the quantity and diversity of the ideas submitted themselves, because there's value to just having a rich pot of ideas that you have available to you, because even if they're not useful today, you have created an opportunity or a wealth of opportunity to derive value from in the future.
Is membership on a yearly subscription?
Yeah, so we're a typical software as a subscription business. So our clients typically pay us on an annual subscription for the entire organization or for their subset of organization. We do provide our software entirely free for any organization that's less than 100 members. So if you have a small organization, you can literally go to ideascale.com, click the Get Started Free, and the software is free for your small or medium-sized organization, or one-person organization for that matter.
Oh, that's interesting. It's global? Ideascale is global?
Yeah, so we have customers now in 25 or 30 countries and employees in 7 countries, I believe.
And how many people are you?
We are about 100 employees right now.
Okay. And is it all product focused, most of your employee composition?
So yeah, one of the things I'm really, really proud of and love kind of bragging about is 70% of my staff is in engineering or product. So unlike a lot of software companies, which are very, very heavy on sales and marketing, 70% of my people are sitting there coding, sitting there fixing bugs, sitting there designing product, doing graphics design, etc.
Okay, so you really are building what you're selling.
Yes. And we're not just trying to build it, but build it in high quality. That's something that I, you know, constantly tell my team internally. I do not want to be out there selling a mediocre subpar product. That's why we invest so much into the product and the engineering.
If I was a customer of Ideascale, what are the top three things that would appeal to me? So I'm almost asking you to replay back what your customers have told you that they love about you.
Sure. I think that there's three things. If you go read our reviews or what our customers ever tell us, you know, if you go look at the Gartners or G2s or Capterras, there's three themes that emerge that people, I think we stand head and shoulders above everyone else on. Number one is the actual quality of the product. Because we invested so much in a good product, you don't get bugs. It just works, which is very unique relative to a lot of other smaller mid-sized software companies. Number two is the ease of use and setup. So this is a software that a large organization theoretically can get set up in 5 minutes. You don't have to spend a month long, bring in consultants, set up the software, have some complex config. For example, if you click Get Started Free on our website, you could be up and running in less than a minute for your organization of 100 people. And number three is our customer support team. One of the things we're very proud of is we have 24/7, 365 live human tech support available. So you could be midnight on Christmas Eve and you need, if something has broken or you just don't know how to do it, you're going to be able to converse with a real human being via our chat on average within 26 seconds. I think last month was 22 seconds, in fact. So 22 seconds after encountering a problem, you can be talking to a human being instead of a chatbot.
Okay, that's impressive. Oh, that's actually very impressive because that's all you get these days, chatbots. I mean, I love them, but sometimes you don't want them.
No, they're good, but like at some point, the problem is too complex, requires a human touch or human empathy. And we've realized that, and therefore we've invested in this round-the-clock, always available support team. Shout out to them, by the way. They do a great job.
Absolutely. I can imagine that. What happens to privacy of ideas?
Sure. So each organization can set their privacy and data security. Obviously, it's something a lot of our customers ask us about. So number one, I want to brag a little bit. We are what's called FedRAMP qualified. That's a very difficult level of data security clearance that you need from the U.S. government. So we have it. We're the only player in our space that does. That means federal government agencies, some with very, very sensitive data, trust us because we have incredible technical and human protocol security on our side. But then separate from that, we also allow you to configure the privacy of your data in very, very, so setting aside the data being secure, which it is, we also allow you to configure the privacy of your data. So you could make your ideas available to the public. So if you're running a public campaign, you could say, hey, all my, you know, for example, let's use my mascot campaign. We wanted everyone in the world to see, hey, here's the ideas that I've submitted. Here's the idea somebody else has submitted, upvote and downvote them, right? That was totally public. All the information anyone in the world could see even without logging in. On the other side, you could make it extremely private where only somebody logged in with a senior title within your organization can see the idea. So anyone can submit them, but only senior people can see them. We generally try and encourage people to have more open communities, at least internally, because that results in a more diverse set of submissions, as well as a more dynamic conversation on what are good ideas versus bad ideas.
Or what is the extent of the use of AI if you're using it?
Sure. So we use AI in primarily one way today, in our product, we only use AI in one way right now, which is it helps you craft your ideas. So one of the challenges we encountered that a lot of our customers face is they have a great idea, but they're not great at writing or articulating, hey, I have this great idea for, let's say, how to make a Tesla brake better or more energy efficient. Help me write it up. So we're using AI right now, primarily to help an individual more coherently and clearly communicate their idea in a way that is understood by other people. That's something that we've had for about a year, and it's, I think, a very powerful feature. The other feature which is coming out in a few months is actually AI-generated ideas. And we've intentionally held off on this because we want it to be a human-centric platform and do so and when we add AI-based ideas, we want it to do so in a very thoughtful way. That is well engineered and respects our clients' concerns about what is human versus AI generated. I think we figured out a good way to do so. And so in a couple of months, we'll be launching that as well.
Wow. That's, that's new territory. And it's also a bit scary territory, right? That because, you know, humans.
Of course, that's why we could have, from a technical point of view, we could have launched it a year ago. It was very easy. Like the actual code for it is, couple hundred lines long, could have been done in an afternoon. But to do it right from a product perspective, that actually creates value for your customers and respects their concerns about AI, privacy, et cetera, is very difficult, which is why we held off for a little bit to make sure, A, everybody got used to AI, firstly, over the past year or two, but secondly, that we also thought about what's the right way to actually put this into a product that is not just jammed in there to say we use AI. Because so many software companies nowadays, they just have started putting AI into their marketing and product without thinking about, hey, is this actually useful or not?
In terms of the industry reach, which industry do you think uses IdeaScale the most? Pharma, financial services, government, education?
We are totally industry agnostic. So we're pretty much any industry that cares about innovation, which really should be everyone, right? Whether you're a finance company or healthcare company. So we are industry agnostic. We're in pretty much every industry. We have oil clients, healthcare clients, pharmaceutical clients, finance clients, consulting clients. We have a huge government business, particularly in the US government, where we are the primary supplier of innovation software because, again, we're the only one security cleared to do so. But we have been involved working with a number of large US government agencies, such as the Post Office, the Transportation Safety Authority, the Coast Guard, NASA, over many, many years.
I guess, do you see any differences like in the way ideas are collected, sifted, scaled in public versus private?
In public versus, like, you mean government versus private sector, or do you mean public campaigns versus private campaigns?
Yes, institutions, exactly.
Okay.
Public sector institutions versus private.
Sure. So I think obviously the goals of a government organization are very different than a private sector organization, right? A private sector organization is either trying to grow revenue or cut costs or decrease employee turnover. I think the goals that our government organizations are trying to achieve tend to be different, much more about citizen engagement, employee engagement, or incremental improvement within, obviously, the greater challenges of bureaucracy that exist within large, well-established government organizations. So that's number one, the goals that are different. Number two is how they tend to execute it. I think our government customers are very careful and thoughtful about the constraints that they have within their organization. Many are unionized, so they have to respect union obligations. Many are subject to, you know, formal mandates. So one of my customers really wanted to use AI, but, you know, last summer, and wanted us to push in AI, but the White House at that point had not broadly authorized U.S. federal government agencies from utilizing AI, so they couldn't. So that's another way that they were, you know, we actually had to turn off the AI features for them because they wanted everything to be 100% human done. Not because they wanted to, but because that was the mandate from, you know, from the White House.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. And you can turn off the AI on everything and it still functions well.
Yeah, exactly. So there's just a switch. If you don't like the AI, pretty much everything is configurable. Again, the core software you can get up and running in like a minute or two, but you have infinite ability to configure, turn things on, off. You don't like this button, you don't like this color, you don't like this AI feature, switch it off. Obviously, I encourage people to leave these cool features on because they're incredibly powerful. But if your organization is uncomfortable, either data privacy or for other reasons, you can switch it off.
I'm very curious, who started IdeaScale? Was it you?
No. So I'm an external CEO hire. I've only been here for about 2 years now, just over 2 years. Two folks started it, Vivek Paskaran, who is the CEO and founder of Question Pro, which is one of the largest survey companies in the world, and Rob Hohen, who was our CEO and co-founder. And Rob led the company for 13 years until he retired and handed me the keys. So obviously big credit to them.
That's quite... I can't say it's ahead of the time, but that's quite something. Probably it followed the tech boom, and they decided that they should probably kind of commercialize innovation and probably democratize it as well. So,
I think our origin story really comes out of the government specifically. So during President Obama, when he was president of the United States, he made a big push for government to be more innovative. Mm-hmm. And Rob and Viv said, hey, if government wants to be more innovative, they need more than just a bunch of consultants or how-to books. They actually need some software and engineering to support that in a systematic way. So they saw this opportunity. In fact, one of our first customers was the White House. And there's a great press release by, I think, the White House Chief of Staff under President Obama saying, hey, we've adopted IdeaScale as our innovation operating system. So that's what our origin story is, really starting with the government. Since then, we've realized, hey, this is a need in not just government organizations in the United States, but also government organizations overseas, private sector organizations, nonprofits. Everyone needs to innovate. Otherwise, your organization obsolesces, right? If you're a snack company and you're not making new snacks or new sodas, you're gone eventually. If you're an oil company and you haven't figured out how to drill better in a more environmentally friendly way, you're gone eventually. Everyone needs to innovate or you obsolesce and become and disappear over time.
I see. Okay, that's interesting. I have this thing that I do every day, which is TIL, the things I learned. And I'm very happy to actually know that IdeaScale, one of the first clients, was the White House. That's very interesting. Because, you know, they are now having their own stance on AI, as they should. So it's kind of interesting to see that it goes back that long, and probably I'm sure it went back long ago.
And also the White House, by the way, has now approved AI, certain types of AI throughout the U.S. federal government as of last November. They just took a year to be thoughtful about it rather than just allow it everywhere, because that's obviously a poor decision for such a powerful technology. Nothing in haste.
Nothing in haste. Going to your story, because we talked business, and when I asked about you, I heard a few things. I heard India, Canada, US. Maybe you can throw a bit of light on your background and why you are now here in Philadelphia.
Sure. So I have a bit of a peculiar immigrant story. My folks, my parents immigrated from India to Canada in the 1980s, and I was born shortly after they immigrated. Back then, as poor kind of immigrants from India whose college degrees weren't accepted, they had to literally start from scratch. It was the classic, we've got $10 in our pocket and the shirt on our back. So they could not afford to raise me. So what do you do when you have a young kid that you can't afford to raise? They actually sent me back to live with my grandmother in India till the age of 5. So I actually did not meet my parents till just before my 5th birthday. I was 100% raised by my grandmother. I remember actually crying when my mother came to take me away from my grandmother, because this was the only parent I'd known for, you know, all of the formative years of my childhood. But at age 5, once my parents were a little bit more settled, like 5 years into their immigrant journey, and, you know, I could enter kindergarten, so they wouldn't have to worry about daycare during the day. They brought me back to Canada. I grew up in a small farm town in Canada called Langley. Basically throughout my child, you know, from age 5 to 18. And at age 18, I had the opportunity to attend a really good college in the United States called Dartmouth, where I pursued my kind of degree in mathematics and physics, which was what I'd always wanted to do since I was 3 or 4 years old. Then the next, you know, 10 years or so, I did a mix of working on Wall Street, going to business school, living in New York for most of that time. And then about 2 years ago, as my wife and I considered kind of that next stage in life and having children, we moved to Philadelphia. And I'm very excited that we're, you know, about to hit that next stage of life in a couple of months with the birth of our first child.
Oh, congratulations. That's indeed a landmark.
Thank you. Yeah, we're very excited and also terrified.
Well, you know, something always has to move to make space, and you'll find the right thing to move to make that space. I used to live in Philly, and so I have very fond memories of living in Philly. It has access to New York City, but you're not in the city. And so it's a very nice culture.
Yeah. My wife still works in New York, by the way, so she goes up every week.
Wow. Okay. A lot of people do that. I knew do that, did that. Do you feel Canadian or do you feel American or Indian?
I feel a mix of everything, right? I certainly was raised with kind of an Indian value system, but my parents were very liberal on kind of religion, marriage, all that fun stuff. I have the Canadian niceness in me, so I'm incredibly polite, comically so. People know when they meet me that, hey, even though this guy speaks with an American accent, he's too nice, so I'm Canadian. And I'm very fortunate to have, the part of the being an immigrant in America is that I really do believe in the American dream here, right? That, hey, anybody, if they work hard, can make it. I really like that part of the American dream or value system. So I would say a healthy mix of, you know, Indian, Canadian, and American at this point.
Do you consider yourself an entrepreneur or an innovator? Because you mentioned a few roles, how do you see yourself?
So I did start a small hedge fund at one point as a one-man business. So I have tried to be an entrepreneur. That business did not ultimately pan out. I wouldn't necessarily consider myself an entrepreneur. I definitely consider myself an innovator, because the way I think about the world goes back to my scientific roots, which is, what are the first principles? What does or doesn't make sense? So whenever I look at a process in the business world, that it's what people have been doing for 5, 10, 20, 100 years, but it doesn't match the first principles, my first instinct is, let's rebuild this from scratch, the right way to do something. That could be an HR process, finance process, a product process. And even before I joined IdeaScale, I was a big believer in the idea meritocracy, that ideas should stand on their own merit, that the best idea should win, regardless of whether it comes from the CEO or from the janitor. And I'm very, very fortunate I have found myself at a company that is literally the product that they build and sell.
Yeah, that's very, it's a great sync of intentions and capabilities, I think. Do you think at any point, not now, you would ever go back to like launching your own business?
It depends, really. If I see an opportunity that makes sense, that creates value, then I would, right? The way I think about it, when you're launching a new venture or business or organization, it needs to do two things. Number one, it needs to create value for someone. So a lot of people start startups just because they think it's a cool idea and it's not necessarily a valid business. I want to start something. If I'm going to start something, I have to think I have a unique insight perspective, as well as someone is going to be willing to pay for it in a way that is, it creates value for someone somewhere that they're willing to pay for it. Number two is this sustainable, right? There's a lot of businesses that are cool on their front. Somebody's willing to pay for it, but it's not a sustainable business because, hey, maybe there's only 10 customers in the world who can pay for it, or maybe it costs $1 million to make a product. The classic example is if you start a restaurant to sell filet mignon steak at, you know, 10 bucks a steak, that is going to be, you know, a bad business because the steak itself costs like 40 bucks. So I would be very open to being an entrepreneur. That would I have to see a right opportunity to do so. And I would not do so just because something sounds cool. There has to be a very thoughtful business behind it.
I mean, I speak to a whole gamut of entrepreneurs. The one I'm releasing into 1 week, he's built eight companies, you know, and I think that's admirable, but there is I haven't done that much. Maybe I will. I don't know. But, you know, it's just like sometimes when you're on a roll, you start collecting ideas. And if you're doing that, you've reached a certain point in your life and all the input that you put into your life outputs sometimes together at the same time. So I'm not going to say anything against that, but I'm always very curious to know what makes people do what they do at any point in time. So do you miss your Wall Street times?
Part of me does, right? I think that there were two really cool things as working an investor on Wall Street. Number one is you're getting exposed to all sorts of unique situations and companies every day. The flood of information is tremendous for learning, right? So one day I might be looking at a pharmaceutical company, the next I'm looking at an aluminum company, the next I'm looking at a legal services company, and you have to very quickly learn a lot about, hey, what does an aluminum company do? How do they make aluminum? Where does aluminum come from? It turns out it comes from something called alumina, which comes from bauxite, which comes from like four different countries in the world. And learning all that and how that, you know, about an industry is a lot. That's number one, that you learn a lot. And number two, you do a lot of analysis. And, you know, growing up or having been educated as a mathematician, physicist, I miss the math side of things, right? I miss the sitting down in a room and being very thoughtful about, hey, how does this all add up, and doing some analysis on it. You do less of that when you're running a company. There's certainly a little bit of analysis, but a lot of it is much more focused on the process of what is going on and making sure that the processes are effective.
Well, I think that's interesting. I have a few Wall Street friends, and it's always very interesting to know what they like. And I must say a lot of them, they've left Wall Street because that's not what they want to do. So it's kind of interesting to hear from your perspective what are the things that you actually miss about it. That makes sense, actually. Now to where you are now and where you want to be in the next, say, 2 to 3 years. What is your outlook for IdeaScale, your personal vision?
Sure. I think that there's a few things that are really cool about what I'm trying to accomplish at IdeaScale and what we as a company are trying to accomplish. Number one is just this year, we went global for the first time. We were really focused on selling to primarily the US geography at the start of this year. We had customers all over the world, but we were really, you know, they were more coincidence than intentional. This year, we expanded our geographic focus to pretty much every major country in the world. And every major geography, so India, Brazil, South Africa, Middle East, Europe, Japan, we've invested a lot of resources behind being a global company and really being the innovation software for the world. Number two is what's coming out on our product line. So about a year ago, we were really only a one product company with our core idea management solution. And we are now trying to launch a full suite of innovation management products that address every pain point that a innovation department or innovation officer has. So about 6 months ago, we launched our whiteboarding solution. In another few months, we'll be launching our our kind of AI idea generation solution. A few months after that, we'll be launching a project management solution. A few months after that, we'll be launching some trend scouting. So there's, we really, over a year ago, we were basically a one module, one product company. And in about a year from now, we should actually have four or five modules that are all kind of addressing different pain points that an innovation department may have. And that way they're able to choose the right product that addresses their pain point, and knowing that they're going to a company that is able to address all or a singular part of their pain points.
You mentioned that the industry, your industry reach is broad, is agnostic. Do you have a focus industry, say, for the next 2 to 3 years as well? Or are you still continuing with being general?
No, I think, again, if I look at our kind of the people who are coming to us and talking to us, either sales opportunities or just for advice, they're all over the place. We have, again, oil companies, finance companies, healthcare companies, national governments, local city governments. The core problem that we're solving is a universal problem. It is the problem that a large, complex organization is set up to do one thing well, and that's what they've been doing for 10 or 20, 30 years. So fundamentally, large, complex organizations are designed to not be innovative. Instead, they're designed to do what they were already doing really efficiently. So the problem of becoming innovative when your organization is not designed to is a universal problem that whether you are Pfizer, ExxonMobil, the US Army, everyone is facing. And it turns out the solutions are also universal to this universal problem. So what works largely for the same approach, cultural changes, technological changes, process changes that'll work for Pfizer are actually very applicable to the US Army and vice versa. And that's why it's very important for, organizations like us, our peers, our competitors, to really be horizontal, because the problem is truly universal and the solution is truly universal.
In the spirit of wrapping up, what are the three takeaways that you can give to the audience as almost like a sales pitch?
I'd say, I usually don't do sales pitches for IdeaScale because I try to remain much more on the product side. But I think the three things why you'd want to come to us are, number one, we're incredibly easy to use. It's very, it takes a minute to set up and get and use. My 80-year-old grandparents could use it. That's how simple the software is. That's number one. Very simple to use. Number two is, we are a company that is really dedicated to addressing innovation software pain points rather than just being a sales and marketing engine the way many software companies are. And number three, we're very accessible as human beings, right? Like, if a customer wants to talk to me, they get me very, very quickly. There was a small bug that happened like 6 months ago, and I personally managed like fixing it and communicating with the customer on a day-to-day basis. Very rarely do you get the CEO of a company, or not just the CEO of a company, our customer support team cares, our marketing team cares, our CSMs care. Like, we actually really care about our clients. Obviously, they make sure that we can keep the lights on, but we believe in their mission and are there to support it truly from the bottom of our hearts.
Wow, that's very, very inspiring, really. So on that note, I'd like to thank you for your time on the podcast. I wish you and IdeaScale years of success.
Thank you so much for having me, Rain.